As Cubo is a UK artist, his website address reflects that, so you can visit him at www.cuboy.co.uk.
That's it for this edition of Audiophile. You can learn more about Audiophile or contact us by visiting our website at www.audiophile.org. That's www.audiophile.org.
Audiophile is produced by Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle, and Christopher David Trenton. I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm J.D. Doyle. Keep listening.
For tuning in to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. This week, Michelle Pleasant, Lee Moore, Steve Pride, Rex Walker with Bill Kelly, Dixie Treichel and John Townsend, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns with John DeBoer, Clive Barker and J.D. Doyle, Chris Wilson and Christopher David Trenton contributed program material. Kate Reed, Folkonomics, and Q-Boy performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is underwritten in part by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to support our work, hear our podcasts, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on WMNF Tampa, Florida, CJMP Powell River, British Columbia, KOOP Austin, Texas, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. For the 1,113th time, please stay tuned.
And you can hear This Way Out.
Birthday's coming up on April 20th.
Ooh, what's that? They sneak those announcements in there. I'm sorry about that. This is WPKM Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk, New York at 88.7 FM. Thank you for tuning in, and thank you for supporting this listener-supported radio station. You can find us on the net at WPKN.org. Get program schedule information. Find out how to volunteer here, as well as how to make a secure online contribution. Right now, we invite you to stay tuned for Counterpoint coming up next, and we'll run down the program in just a moment. But first, we have these announcements.
WPKN has long been a favorite haven for artists and craftspeople who listen to the station while they work in their studios all day or night. And this talented group has helped the station in the past by donating the fruits of their creativity to several successful benefit art auctions and sales. Now we're looking to do it again with WPKN Art Fest 2009, which will take place during New Haven's annual Open Studios event, hosted by ArtSpace and being held this year on October 3rd and 4th. WPKN Art Fest will be held at Erector Square, a highly popular Open Studios venue. Right now, we're sending out a call for artists. If you would be interested in donating one of your artworks to this benefit sale, please send an email to WPKNArtFest@earthlink.net. Describe the kind of work you do, or even send an image if possible. One work from each artist will be sold to benefit the radio station, and we hope to turn this into a fun weekend with music and live broadcasts from the site. Please indicate as well if you would be willing to volunteer some of your time to help out during the event. Again, to indicate your interest in being part of WPCAN Art Fest 2009, please send an email to wpcanartfest@earthlink.net. And thanks.
The California 66 concert is just a few weeks away. It's a Woodstock kind of night with the original Blues Magoos, the Electric Prunes, and the band Love with Johnny Eccles and Baby Lemonade in their only Connecticut appearance. And just added an exclusive psychedelic light show by the Fillmore East's Pig Light Show. Be a part of music history on August 6th for this one-night-only concert. Tickets are limited, so get them now. California 66 is a benefit concert for WPKN Radio on Thursday, August 6th at the Quick Center, Fairfield University in Fairfield, Connecticut. Tickets are available online at quickcenter.com or through the box office at 203-254-4010. California 66 benefit tickets are $66 for adults and $33 for students and are tax deductible to the extent allowed. This benefit concert for WPKN is dedicated to the late Sky Saxon from the Seeds.
WPKN, we need volunteers. There's a lot of things you can do, from working at events, from folk to jazz, to clerical, to electrical engineering and maintenance, to tax, to accounting. We need help. Volunteers, please join the staff to assist us at a musical or art festival. Staffing the WPK on time, handing out program guides and bumper stickers, greeting people, and encouraging them to listen to our shows. Bob Shapiro, Phil Bowler, Terry Hopper, Pete Stewart, to PKN and all the variety the station offers. We are in search of new volunteers. If for only one timer or on a steady basis, come on in, come on down. Our doors are open, so get on board. If you're interested in volunteering at WPKN, our volunteer coordinator is iTone. Please send an email to volunteer@wpkn.org. Or call the station during business hours at 203-331-9756.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Turn world to its own needs. Tell me, serve your own needs, beat it up a knock, speak, grunt, no strength, the ladder starts to clatter with fear, fight down, high choir and a fire, representatives have engaged in a government for hire and a combat site, NATO weapons are coming in a hurry with the fury breathing down your neck, keep my team reporters, Battle Trump, Kevin Kraft, look at that, no plane, fine, then, uh-oh, overflow, population common, do what it'll do, save yourself, serve yourself, world, serve your own needs, listen to your heartbeat, tell me what the rapture is, the reverend and the right, right, you slice and burn, return, listen to yourself, churn. Locking in, uniform and book, burning blood, letting every motive escalate. Automotive, centering, light a candle, light a motor, step down, step down. Watch your heel, crush, crush, uh-oh, this means no fear. Cavalier, renegade, steer clear, a tournament of lies. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline.
It's the end of the world. We'll be right back.
Good evening and welcome to Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris here Mondays between 8 and 10 p.m. We're glad you could join us for another edition of the show. And tonight we have a number of topics we're going to be talking about, including a discussion of the coup d'etat in Honduras with Lisa Sullivan. She is a Latin America coordinator with the group School of the Americas Watch. David Carey's professor of constitutional law at Temple University will be exploring with us both the coming confirmation, likely confirmation of Judge Sonia Sotomayor, as well as the recent confrontation between Henry Louis Gates, the Harvard scholar, and the Cambridge, Massachusetts police officer, and the wider meaning of that. And lastly, we're going to be hearing from a representative of the Universal Healthcare Foundation of Connecticut, which, against all odds, overrode Connecticut Governor Rell's veto in the House and Senate just last Monday, a week ago, put in place a universal healthcare program called Sustinet. We'll find out what the next steps are in that process a little later tonight. But right now, I'd like to welcome to our program, first off, Nate Cardozo. He is Open Government Legal Fellow with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and he's here to talk about a recently filed Freedom of Information Act lawsuit filed with the courts in San Francisco over intelligence agencies misconduct here in the United States. Nate, thanks so much for being here with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Last Wednesday, the Electronic Frontier Foundation filed a lawsuit under the Freedom of Information Act, demanding documents from the CIA and lots of other U.S. intelligence agencies, the State Department, Energy Department, that would reveal activities conducted by these agencies that were in violation of U.S. law. Can you just summarize for us sort of the end goal of this lawsuit?
The end goal of the lawsuit that I helped file with EFF is sunshine and openness in government and intelligence oversight. The intelligence agencies of the federal government are required by executive order to report questions that they have regarding the legality of their acts to a body called the Intelligence Oversight Board. And the goal of this Freedom of Information Act lawsuit is to make those reports public, to get the intelligence agencies' questions about their own potential misconduct out in the light of day so that the American people can see what the President and what Congress, hopefully, have been able to see about our intelligence activities over the last 8.5 years.
Certainly, there's been a lot of information flowing out either through press reports or leaks about the misconduct of the Bush administration, war on terror in particular, eavesdropping, torture, and the like. Is there any particular misconduct that you are after in this lawsuit?
No, nothing in particular. EFF's mission surrounds the Internet and technology and the intersection of the Internet and democracy. So we are particularly interested in things like electronic surveillance, wiretapping, data mining, things like that. But our FOIA request goes much broader than that. It goes to any misconduct that the intelligence agencies have self-reported. We're really interested in things we don't know about. I mean, we know about the NSA's warrantless wiretapping. We're more interested in things that have been reported in the press as other intelligence activities. We don't really know what that is, and we'd like to find out.
As I understand it, the Electronic Frontier Foundation and yourself filed the original request for these documents under the Freedom of Information Act back in February 2008, and you did get a smattering of some documents, but from what I understand, they weren't all that useful. You want to explain?
Yeah. Well, most of the agencies to whom we sent these requests in February of 2008 simply ignored the requests. The CIA, the FBI, the Defense Intelligence Agency completely ignored the requests. We did get a little bit of information back from the NSA, the National Security Agency, a little bit from Energy, and a little bit from the Coast Guard. NSAs were really the only ones that were interesting to us, but they were too heavily redacted to be able to glean anything from.
So now you come up with this lawsuit, and maybe you could talk a little bit about the Intelligence Oversight Board, which was created in 1976, and this was supposed to be the conduit for internal investigations that revealed misconduct. Depending on their seriousness, they could have been sent on to the president or the attorney general for prosecution. It's a very secret board. What can you tell us about the Intelligence Oversight Board and how it's been capable of oversight or incapable of fulfilling those duties?
Well, it's interesting how little I can tell you about the Intelligence Oversight Board or the IOB. We don't know very much about it at all. It's a civilian board appointed by the president and serves at the president's pleasure, and it's the primary mechanism for intelligence oversight within the executive branch. The inspectors general of every intelligence agency within the government are required to file reports with the IOB, it used to be quarterly, of any time they had questions regarding their conduct. The IOB reviewed the reports and then, as you said, either forwarded them to the attorney general if they felt that that was appropriate, or to the president, or to the director of Central Intelligence, who became the director of National Intelligence. The members of the IOB are drawn by the president from civilian life, aren't necessarily people with any intelligence background. And interestingly, President Obama has not appointed anyone to the IOB, so it currently sits empty. So whether the IOB is functioning at all right now is another determining whether it's functioning at all is another goal of the lawsuit that we filed.
We're speaking with Nick Cardozo, Open Government Legal Fellow with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and we're discussing their recently filed Freedom of Information Act lawsuit to demand documents relating to intelligence agencies' misconduct here in the United States. And although the Electronic Frontier Foundation's original request for documents was filed back in February of 2008. Since that original request, there have been reports in the press about former Vice President Dick Cheney that he'd ordered the CIA not to reveal to Congress details about a CIA assassination squad targeting al-Qaeda operatives and their supporters. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. We filed these requests long before we knew anything about Dick Cheney's involvement in CIA activities. The requests, however, would cover such information. And the request under the Freedom of Information Act to the intelligence agencies now is all the more important. If the intelligence agencies have been less than forthright with Congress, then the IOB is really all that's left in terms of intelligence oversight. It would be, if the intelligence agencies had any questions about whether assassinating a secret program to assassinate foreign leaders was legal, and it seems like there probably were some people within the intelligence community who had such questions, those questions would have been lodged with the Intelligence Oversight Board. So even if Congress didn't know about it, and apparently Congress was kept in the dark until just last week or the week before about that secret program, there was supposed to be some intelligence oversight going on. And if that board was doing its job, it would be interesting to know if they forwarded those reports on to the Attorney General and what the Attorney General did with those reports. In our lawsuit, we're suing not just the intelligence agencies, but the Attorney General and the Director of National Intelligence to see what they did with these reports. So it's not just that we're asking for the reports of misconduct themselves, but also we're asking for the Attorney General's response to these reports. So not just the misconduct, but what was done with the reports of the misconduct is part of the suit that we're seeking.
Nate, if there was any action on the part of the Attorney General or any other official in the government regarding misconduct, given that some of these activities are covert, would they be revealed in your FOIA request, or would they be a classified secret by the government?
Well, that's a big it depends. If the government claims that these reports are exempt from the Freedom of Information Act under national security, we would like to get a judge to take a look at the reports to see if if the Attorney General or the IOB or the Director of National Intelligence concluded that the activities reported were illegal. Because under the Freedom of Information Act and under the law as it stands today, the intelligence agencies cannot claim a national security exemption if the acts reported were, in fact, illegal. So if the CIA reported this considered program to assassinate foreign leaders to the IOB, the IOB forwarded it on to the Attorney General, who, if he was acting intellectually honestly, would have concluded that the program was illegal, then the CIA would not be allowed to claim a national security exemption. You can only claim that. You can only refuse to release a document under the Freedom of Information Act on national security grounds if the underlying actions are legal. If they're illegal, then national security is not an appropriate response. If the documents are classified, which we haven't seen, by the way, we haven't seen the documents that we got from the NSA were redacted under the national security exemption, not under a classified documents exemption. So if the agencies were to claim that these reports were classified, that would be a different story, but we haven't seen that yet. So we're seeking to get the information in front of a judge because it really is the judiciary who should be making the call about what the American people gets to see, not the executive itself.
We know that there are many members of Congress unhappy with U.S. intelligence agencies not bringing to Congress critical information about these covert intelligence programs. The House Intelligence Committee decided last week to investigate a number of issues, including this CIA assassination squad, as well as Bush's warrantless domestic wiretapping, use of waterboarding, abuse of prisoners, as well as the destruction of videotapes of harsh interrogations. In the end, do you think Congress has the will or the power to change the people's representatives' relationship with intelligence agencies to gain for itself more clout in this process?
Well, I sure hope so. It seems like the Congress, it seems like what the CIA did by keeping Congress in the dark for so long has finally made, especially the intelligence committees of the House and Senate, angry enough to put teeth behind their threats. I sure hope that Congress will reform its relationship with the intelligence community and get the intelligence community talking to them and keeping them informed. Because Congress is entitled to see even classified documents that we would not be entitled to see under the Freedom of Information Act. And it is disturbing that the CIA has kept Congress in the dark for so long about such a fundamentally problematic program.
One of the issues that I know you probably looked into is that in this issue of Nancy Pelosi and the controversy, you know, a month or two ago that erupted over whether she and other members of the Democratic Party were briefed on the torture techniques employed by the Bush administration, there were claims by Democrats that the CIA had a long history of lying to Congress. Republicans said, oh, no, they've never lied. But, of course, there is a documented history of the CIA misleading Congress and the American people generally. But there was some specific concern about who selected members of Congress to be briefed. In other words, I don't believe it was the prerogative of the Speaker of the House or the Majority Leader in the Senate who was going to get these briefings from the CIA. Basically, it was the executive branch who was selecting who would know what was going on. And, of course, there were questions about some senators and representatives not really having the knowledge base enough to ask the right questions or fully understand what was being told to them. And of course, there were accusations that the CIA briefers were, you know, deliberately misleading or using jargon that these legislators really couldn't interpret. You want to comment on that?
I have no comment specifically to that. I've been following the Nancy Pelosi CIA row as an interested citizen, but I don't have a direct involvement in it. This lawsuit that we filed last week, I think, will be useful in the whole debate, because part of the problem with congressional oversight, as you pointed out, of the intelligence community is that they're not experts, and the intelligence community can talk around a lot of things that are potentially illegal. But the reports filed with the Intelligence Oversight Board are filed by the inspectors general of the intelligence agencies talking to other intelligence professionals. So there, hopefully we won't see the same sorts of issues that Congress had a problem with. We won't see talking, beating around the bush or trying to gloss over issues. These are supposed to be really candid questions to a board saying, it looks like this particular intelligence activity may have been illegal. What do you think? The point of the Intelligence Oversight Board and the point of the reports to the IOB is to get the kind of candid admissions and discussions going that it seems Congress has been cut out of. So seeing what the inspectors general really thought is hopefully one of the products that we'll get from this suit, even if Congress hasn't been able to see it.
President Bush signed an executive order before he left office that removed criminal referrals as the primary function of the Intelligence Oversight Board. And as you said just a little while ago, President Obama has not appointed any members of this board since he took office in January 2009. Maybe you could talk a little bit about why President Bush signed that executive order and the effect it's having on you know, the substance of what you're requesting now, and for those who might request similar information in the future.
Sure. So the Intelligence Oversight Board no longer has the authority to refer cases of misconduct to the Attorney General. That authority has been shifted to the Director of National Intelligence. The executive order that you referred to, signed in February of 2008, was surrounding the creation of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. So the DNI now does a lot of what the Intelligence Oversight Board used to do. And our requests in February of 2008 came just before, like 4 days before that executive order.
Well, do you think they're connected?
I don't know if they're connected. We updated our requests just last month in June of 2009 to include the Director of National Intelligence. So the lawsuit covers the Director of National Intelligence now through June of 2009 to see what he has done with the reports that used to go to the Intelligence Oversight Board. The DNI now has the authority and the responsibility to forward the reports that he believes to be a violation of criminal law along to the Attorney General. So it's not just the Intelligence Oversight Board anymore, it's the Director of National Intelligence as well. It's possible that the reason that President Obama has not nominated anyone to the IOB is the fact that the IOB is now essentially toothless, and the teeth, if you will, have been transferred over to the DNI. But our suit now covers the DNI, so we'll be able to get the same information from the Director of National Intelligence as we originally sought from the Intelligence Oversight Board.
In your view, would it be the right course of action for President Obama to reverse President Bush's executive order and put the authority back on this oversight board rather than on the Director of Intelligence, the Director of National Intelligence?
I think it would be a wise move, and here's why. The Director of National Intelligence himself runs an intelligence agency that is subject to the same executive order. It's the fox guarding the hen house. It's the Director of National Intelligence now has to report his own questions about his own intelligence activities to himself, and then I guess would forward those along to the Attorney General. If he felt that he had broken the law, he would request that he be prosecuted. It just doesn't make any sense. It made a lot more sense to have a neutral, nonpartisan, civilian oversight board that was not a party to the conversation. Someone who could look at intelligence activities with a neutral eye, not as a participant, and say, wait a second, this is illegal, or this is unconstitutional, or this violates executive order or presidential directive, and the Attorney General needs to know about it. Now it's the Director of National Intelligence who's coordinating the entire intelligence community, who's providing the oversight. And that's a little bit of a conflict of interest, possibly more than a little bit of a conflict of interest. So our requests the DNI, I think will be interesting to see how he responds, if he has in fact forwarded anything over the last 18 months to the Attorney General. If he has, then great, intelligence oversight is working. If not, then that raises a question of really do we need to go back to a civilian oversight board.
There are many civil libertarians who are very upset with President Obama and how he's dealt with prosecutions of former Bush administration officials who may be guilty of war crimes and breaking of U.S. and international law, as well as some of the positions he's taken on warrantless surveillance. Could it be that President Obama has not reversed this Bush administration executive order on really making the board, the Intelligence Oversight Board, toothless, because he's now very jealously protecting the prerogatives of the Oval Office, maybe certainly in contradiction to what his campaign pledges were?
You know, I sure hope not. On January 21st, when President Obama took office, he issued a memorandum regarding the Freedom of Information Act. He called the FOIA the most prominent expression of a profound national commitment to ensuring open government. He quoted Justice Brandeis as saying, "Sunlight is said to be the best of disinfectants." Let's hope that he keeps those promises and keeps to that to the touchstone of open government and democracy, and responds forthrightly to this request. And if he doesn't, you know, then maybe those civil libertarians who have concerns that it's more of the same, maybe they're right. For now, I think we here at the Electronic Frontier Foundation are reserving judgment. We're skeptically optimistic, but optimistic nonetheless.
Well, lastly, I just want to ask you about the chances that you see. Is it likely that a judge hearing your Freedom of Information Act request will rule in your favor, given that the intelligence agencies so often prevail in these kinds of cases when they claim national security? And I note, of course, what you said earlier, that if these were illegal activities, they cannot claim national security grounds for keeping the secret from the American public. But, these things have a way of getting messed up down the line in a judge's chambers when people claim dire consequences if particular information is released. But you think this will fly?
Again, I sure hope so. I can't claim to be clairvoyant here. I don't know how the judge is going to rule. And frankly, I don't know how the agencies are going to respond. The Freedom of Information Act gave the agencies 20 working days to respond to our original request, and that was in February of 2008, and we have literally heard nothing from several of these agencies, including the CIA. So they're already in violation of the law by an order of magnitude. They're quite late. So let's hope that the judge looks at that and says, you know, enough is enough. Time to stop dragging your heels and get this stuff released to the public in its entirety with the legitimate classified stuff redacted, that's fine, but we need to know what the questions regarding the legality of America's intelligence activities were. We need to get that stuff out.
Just one last note here, though. Do you feel that if you do get a lot of this information and then there are illegal conduct is revealed, could it be the basis for prosecution that has not yet occurred to date because of the public revelations?
Anything's possible. It would be the Attorney General's prerogative to do that. Obviously, the Electronic Frontier Foundation is not in a position for criminal prosecution. But hopefully it would spark at least discussion among Congress and the intelligence community regarding why this stuff wasn't prosecuted in the first place. Anything's possible.
Well, I think certainly public pressure is a huge part of this, because President Obama, as you restated his eloquent utterings during the inauguration, he's got to follow up on that. And when he doesn't, people have to scream loud, because otherwise those campaign pledges are just so much trash. So I'm hoping, as you are, that they will follow through. But we've been disappointed by some of their conduct in the first 6 months.
And if they don't follow through, then it'll be up to us to raise heck and point out that they're not following through and that they're claiming national security, even though it's reports of potential lawbreaking.
So. Exactly. Well, Nate, thanks so much for making time for us tonight. And please do leave our listeners with your website and any other resource material that would lead our listeners to a better understanding of this.
Sure. The Electronic Frontier Foundation's website is www.eff.org. And on our front page, we have a link to this Freedom of Information Act lawsuit and our press release about it under EFF updates. And all the information you could possibly want is there.
All right. Well, again, thanks for all your work, Nate. You guys over at the Electronic Frontier Foundation do incredibly important work, and I thank you for all that you do, and I know I speak for a lot of our listeners as well. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, Scott.
Good night. Bye-bye. Nate Cardozo, Open Government Legal Fellow with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Again, their website is EFF.org. This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM, WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM, our website WPKN.org. My name is Scott Harris. The program is Counterpoint. We continue with a discussion of the coup d'etat in Honduras and an update on that situation in just a minute. Stay with us.
Vibrato, vibrato, vibrato. Everyone's a winner, bargains galore. That's right, you two can be the proud owner. The quality goes in before that name goes on. One-tenth of a dollar, one-tenth of a dollar. We got service after sale. How about perfume? We got perfume. How about an engagement ring? Some for the little lady, some for the little lady, some for the little lady. $3-$4. We got a year-end clearance. We got our white sale and a smoke-damaged furniture. You can drive it away today. Act now, and receive as our gift to you. They come in all colors, one size fits all. No muss, no fuss, no spill. You're tired of kitchen drudgery. Everything must go. Going out of business, going out of business, going out of business sale. 50% off original retail price. Skip the middle man. Don't settle for less. How do we do it? How do we do it? Volume, volume. Turn up the volume. You heard it advertised. Don't hesitate. Don't be caught with your drawers down. Don't be caught with your drawers down. Step right up. Step right up. That's right. It plays and chops. Dots and slices. Never stops. Lasts a lifetime. Moves your lawn. And it moves your lawn. It picks up the kids from school. Unwanted facial hair, it gets rid of embarrassing age spots, it delivers a pizza, and it lengthens, and it strengthens, and it finds that slipper that's bent large under the chaise lounge for several weeks, and it plays a mean rhythm master, it makes excuses for unwanted lipstick on your collar, and it's only a dollar, step right up, it's only a dollar, step right up, cause it forges your signature, not completely satisfied, kneel back on you, forcing the product for complete on the price of places. Step right up. Please allow 30 days for delivery. Don't be fooled by cheap imitations. You can live in it, laughing it, loving it, swimming it, sleeping it, living it, swimming it, laughing it, loving it. Remove embarrassing stains from contour sheets. That's right. And it entertains visiting relatives. It turns a sandwich into a banquet. Tired of being the life of the party. Change your shorts, change your life, change your life. Change into a 9-year-old Hindu. Get rid of your wife, and it walks your dog, and it doubles on sex. Doubles on sex, you can jump back, Jack. See you later, alligator. See you later, alligator, and it steals your car. It gets rid of your gambling debts, it quits smoking, it's a friend, it's a companion, it's the only product you will ever need. Follow these easy assembly instructions, it never needs ironing. Well, it takes weights off hips, bust, thighs, chin, midriff, gives you dandruff, and it finds you a job. It is a job. And it strips the phone company free day send for private exchange. And it gives you denture breath. And you know it's a friend. And it's a companion. And it gets rid of your traveler's checks. It's new, it's improved, it's old fashioned. Well, it takes care of business. Never needs binding, never needs binding, never needs binding. Gets rid of blackheads, heartbreak, and psoriasis. Christ, you don't know the meaning of heartbreak, buddy. Come on, come on. Come on, come on. It's defective. It creates household odors. It disinfects. It sanitizes. redeemable coupon, no obligation, no salesman will visit your home. We got a jackpot, jackpot, jackpot. Prizes, 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 all worth guaranteed. How do we do it? 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 We need your business. We're going out of business. We'll give you the business. Get on the business end of all. Going out of business. Say we'll receive all. Free brochure. Free brochure. Read the easy to follow assembly instructions. Batteries not included. Send before midnight tomorrow. Terms available. Step right up. Step right up. Step right up. You got it, buddy. A large print givers and a small print takers away. Step right up. You can step right up. You can step right up. Come on, step right up. Get away from me, can you, buddy?
Step right up from a guy named Tom Waits that you all know about. Right now here on Counterpoint, we are at a loggerhead with our guest, our scheduled guest from the School of the Americas Watch, Lisa Sullivan, unreachable at this moment. She moves between the United States and Venezuela and Honduras, and for some reason I'm having trouble getting her on the phone, and of course that happens sometimes. So until we reach her in a couple of minutes, or... on the other hand, if we don't reach her, we'll be hearing some interviews from the Between the Lines program this week. The first thing that we're going to listen to is a discussion of the minimum wage, because just this past week, the minimum wage kicked up in the third of a three-phase increase of minimum wage around the country. And there are bigger issues at stake in terms of a living wage for people who can't raise a family or make ends meet on a minimum wage salary. So we're going to go to that right now, and if we happen to get our guest Lisa Sullivan on the line, we will return with her to talk about Honduras. Otherwise, we might push that off until next week. But we have more in store for you tonight, including a discussion of Supreme Court Justice nominee Judge Sonia Sotomayor, and so a little bit of discussion on the confrontation between Henry Louis Gates Jr., Harvard scholar, and a Cambridge, Massachusetts police officer. That's coming up with David Carey's, professor of constitutional law at Temple University. We're also going to be talking about the implementation phase of the new Sustinet law here in Connecticut that was voted in last Monday evening, overriding Governor Jody Rell's veto. So a new form of universal health care on the books, voted in by the state legislature, and we'll be hearing more details about that from an individual from the Universal Healthcare Foundation of Connecticut. So with that said, we'll move off right now to take a listen to a discussion about minimum wage, and this is Melinda Tu who's conducting this interview, so we'll be back in just a little bit with our guest talking about Sotomayor and race relations generally in this country. But right now, some segment from BTL.
As some Wall Street firms announce post-taxpayer bailout record profits, there's a tiny bit of good news at the other end of the economic spectrum. On July 24th, the third and final increase in a three-tier federal minimum wage law goes into effect, raising wages for the lowest-paid workers covered under the law from $6.55 an hour to $7.25. The first increase in 10 years sent the minimum wage from $5.15 to $5.85 in 2007. Even though the latest increase means an additional $1,400 a year for full-time workers, their new salary totals just over $15,000 annually. not really enough for one person to live on, much less a family. The minimum wage, instituted during the Great Depression, mandated a national base pay for all workers. However, during the intervening years, wage earners have suffered a dramatic decrease in buying power that exacerbates the financial crisis many working families find themselves in during the nation's current severe recession. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Holly Sklar, senior policy advisor for the Let Justice Roll Living Wage Campaign. She explains that the campaign's goal is not just incremental increases in the minimum wage, but a real living wage equal to what workers earned 50 years ago, adjusted for inflation.
The minimum wage really does set the wage floor. And when the federal minimum wage is stuck at a poverty wage, it's basically allowing employers, sending a real green light for employers to pay poverty wages to a growing share of the workforce, like we've been seeing. And so the minimum wage is not just about minimum wage workers, but it's about setting the floor under all workers, setting the floor under our economy as a whole, making for a strong foundation. If you adjust for inflation, this minimum wage increase that we're going to have, the 7.25 rate starting July 24th, is still lower than a minimum wage worker earned in 1956, if you adjust for the cost of living. They earned $7.86. So we haven't even caught up back to 1956, much less back to 1968. And 1968 was the high point of the buying power of the minimum wage. So again, adjusting for inflation, it would take $9.83 in today's dollars just to match the buying power of the minimum wage of 1968. And I always think it's important to point out that 1968 is the year that Martin Luther King was killed, fighting for living wages for sanitation workers in Memphis and fighting for living wages for all workers. And the minimum wage of 1968 was much higher than the one today.
Well, business has always fought an increase in the minimum wage. You know, obviously, in a way, it's in their self-interest, but they don't present it that way. They present it as something that would inhibit job growth. Can you respond to that?
Sure. First of all, most businesses haven't always fought it. Many businesses fight it, and in particular, certain business lobbies, like the Chamber of Commerce, fight it. On the other hand, the U.S. Women's Chamber of Commerce, to take an important example, was very much for raising the minimum wage. And so that's part of the problem here, that it's been kind of a dominance by the lobbies that have tried to, you know, they always say, oh, we can't raise the minimum wage now because the economy's bad. But then when the economy's good, they say we can't raise it now because that'll make the economy bad. The reality is they don't want a minimum wage at all. You know, if they had their way, it would be abolished. The kind of the parallel I like to use is the Roosevelt administration when they were trying to get out of the Depression, because that's when the minimum wage was first enacted. It was enacted during the Great Depression. Now we're in the second worst crisis, we're in the worst crisis, actually, since the Great Depression. So the minimum wage was enacted during the Depression because they understood not only did they want to try and put a floor into workers to try and assure workers a fair day pay for a fair day's work, but they also understood that one of the reasons we were in the Depression was because there wasn't enough consumer buying power, enough consumer purchasing power. And so they wanted to raise wages to increase consumer purchasing power, which in turn would stimulate more business and would help the economy recover. Roosevelt called the minimum wage an essential part of economic recovery.
Holly Sklar, this Let Justice Roll Living Wage campaign, it goes beyond the latest increase in the federal minimum wage, as important as that is. Do you have a dollar amount in mind, or what's your next step?
We have a very concrete next step. We believe that, the decade between 1997 and 2007, when the minimum wage was not raised by Congress, that was the longest period in history without a minimum wage increase. In the 1980s, we had the second longest period without an increase. So we've really had these too little, too late raises. And so in order to break this cycle of too little, too late raises, we want a more significant next step. And so we're calling for $10 in 2010 in terms of the federal minimum wage. That's our next ask, $10 in 2010. That will make up the ground lost since 1968. And that will then put us on the road to be able to bring the minimum wage to a living wage 10 and 2010 is not going to do that in one, you know, fell swoop, but 10 and 2010 is a reasonable next step. It's affordable for business. The economy needs it, and it's going to, again, make up the ground loss and put us back on the road to bring the minimum wage to a living wage.
That was Holly Sklar of the Let Justice Roll Living Wage Campaign. Contact the campaign by calling area code 617-522-2923 or visit their website at letjusticeroll.org. According to news reports, President Obama's Attorney General Eric Holder is considering the appointment of a criminal prosecutor to investigate Bush administration officials who authorized the torture and abuse of U.S.-held detainees in Iraq, Afghanistan, Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and secret CIA jails. A growing body of evidence exposing American torture includes the Obama administration's release of memos written by Bush administration lawyers authorizing torture and a 2007 International Committee of the Red Cross confidential report documenting interrogation abuse at U.S. CIA-run secret prisons. The report condemned America's treatment of 14 high-value terrorist suspect detainees held at secret black sites as torture and inhuman, violating U.S. and international law. Despite President Obama's inclination to look forward rather than backward with regard to the Bush administration's torture program, many human rights groups support an investigation and prosecution of government officials who were complicit in ordering torture of American-held prisoners. Human Rights Watch Executive Director Kenneth Roth said, "The United States can't truly claim to have repudiated these egregious human rights violations unless it returns to the day when it treated them as crimes rather than as policy options." Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Christopher H. Pyle, professor of politics at Mount Holyoke College and a former U.S. Army intelligence officer that helped expose and end the U.S. military's domestic surveillance program in 1970. Pyle, author of a new book titled Getting Away with Torture, Secret Government, War Crimes, and the Rule of Law, discusses the choices facing Attorney General Holder and the nation on prosecuting torture.
The first indication that I had that the administration was planning torture occurred on November 13, 2001, when I read in the New York Times the president's military order creating military commissions. And buried in that order was a provision that said that these new courts, created by the president alone, only to try foreign terrorists, were permitted to ignore the traditional rules of evidence. Now, there's only one reason why you would ignore the traditional rules of evidence. And that is because you want to admit evidence obtained by torture or obtained from people who are not present to testify against the accused. In other words, hearsay, rumor, what have you. Well, that was the first indication. The second indication came on February 7, 2002, when the president announced that the troops did not have to follow the Geneva Conventions on land warfare when dealing with the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. When you unleash your military from having to follow the laws of war, you unleash a terrible retribution. We pioneered the rules of land warfare to control our own troops as well as to protect our troops should they be captured by our enemies. And George W. Bush just waved those treaties aside as if he had that legal authority. He did not. The Supreme Court eventually reversed him. He unleashed the military to do all sorts of things to prisoners with the full knowledge that they would not be prosecuted. And, of course, only a few of them been prosecuted, and those that were prosecuted essentially were convicted for having photographed what they were doing. That was their great offense. People who really got in trouble were the people who were photographed or photographed the abuse of prisoners at Abu Ghraib. The superiors went free, and they went free because of a massive cover-up orchestrated from the Pentagon down. And that was necessary because Secretary Rumsfeld was giving orders directly to the colonel in charge of interrogations at Abu Ghraib.
Christopher Pyle, President Barack Obama's famous since taking office, that he wants to look forward and not backward as an answer to those critics who want Bush administration officials held accountable for breaking the law. We have some indications recently that Eric Holder, President Obama's attorney general, may be considering appointing a special prosecutor to investigate U.S. officials who authorized torture. What kind of investigation would you advise Attorney General Holder to conduct if he was to take that step?
Well, I would advise the Attorney General to appoint a special prosecutor, probably a distinguished Republican lawyer, and give him carte blanche to investigate the policy of torture. That's essential if we are to restore the rule of law in the United States. Now, President Obama made a terrible mistake when he took Leon Panetta's advice, Leon's the director of the CIA, to reassure CIA agents they would not be prosecuted if they followed the Justice Department's legal memoranda when doing the torture. Holder is now in a very difficult position because it is his job, his sworn duty, to enforce the criminal law. I don't think he wants to end up to be as discredited as his Republican predecessors. On the other hand, he's got a big political problem with his administration, which has a lot of other extremely important priorities. They don't want prosecutions to disrupt the efforts to pass a health care policy. I can see that, but I see that more as a matter of timing. The point is you need a special prosecutor to undertake an investigation. The investigation will take at least a year, even with a big staff, and it's time to get on it because we need to reclaim the reputation of this nation, our own self-respect as well as the respect of other nations. And there's no way to do that unless we hold our own political criminals accountable for their crimes. And the Bush administration was full of people who were part of a major criminal conspiracy to commit felonies of the worst kind.
We hear a lot of polls and a lot of chatter out there since this debate on torture has come to light in the United States. People, it seems, maybe are influenced by TV shows that promote and glamorize torture, like the show 24. And there's a lot of concern about terrorism and a lot of spirit of revenge for what took place on September 11, 2001. But where do you think the public stands on torture and holding to account Bush administration officials who tortured many people held by this country, many of them completely innocent of whatever allegations were made against them?
If there's another terrorist attack, the public will want torture, and there'll be a slight majority in favor of it. If there's no attack and the country feels secure, then we're more likely to go back to traditional law enforcement. The real question should be, would you release the entire military and our secret intelligence agencies from any obligation to obey the criminal law? Would you let them kidnap people out of the United States? Would you let them create secret prisons for the CIA in 8 foreign countries? And most people would answer those questions. No, I don't think that would be a good idea. That's giving them too much power. The founders understood all this, but we've slipped away from that tradition, that heritage.
That was Christopher H. Pyle, professor of politics at Mount Holyoke College. Pyle is the author of the new book, Getting Away with Torture, Secret Government, War Crimes, and the Rule of Law.
I say you fit in, never release yourself. Colo mentality.
If you say you be colonial man, you don't be slave from before. They don't release you now, but you never release yourself.
It be so, them they do, them they overdo. They taste it, them they do.
It be so,
them they do, them they do, them they overdo. All they taste it, them they do.
It be so,
them they do, them they think it's them.
better pass them, brother. No be so.
If be so.
If be so, them they do, them they think is them they better pass them, brother. No be so.
If be so.
The tin with black no good. The foreign taste them they like. No be so.
If be so.
The tin with black no good. The foreign taste them they like. No be so.
If be so.
Them go down your condition and close them country away. No be so.
If be so.
Them go down your condition and close them country away. No be so.
If be so.
Them judge him go cocky wink and tell him brother away. No be so.
If be so.
Them judge him go put him weak and tell him brother away. No be so.
If be so.
Them go proud of them name and put them slave name for head. No be so.
If be so.
Them go proud of them name and put them slave name for head. No be so.
If be so.
Colour mentality now make you hear me now.
Music from the late great Nigerian artist Fela, and that was a song called Colonial Mentality. Here on WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk, New York at 88.7 FM. My name is Scott Harris. The program is Counterpoint, and you can go to our website to find out more about this program's this station's program schedule, as well as how to get involved, volunteer, and make contributions. That's WPKN.org. Up in a little while in the program, we're going to be talking about a universal health care bill that was passed, overriding a veto of Connecticut Governor Rell. And we're going to be speaking about the Sustanet bill passing the House and Senate just this past Monday. And we'll be finding out about the universal health care implementation here in the state of Connecticut, what it all means, what the next steps are. But right now, I want to welcome to our program David Carries, professor of constitutional law at Temple University Law School and one of the nation's leading civil rights attorneys. He is the author of the new book titled Philadelphia Freedom, Memoir of a Civil Rights Lawyer. David, thanks so much for being here with us tonight on Counterpoint.
Oh, thanks for inviting me, Scott.
And we had a couple of topics we wanted to focus on with you this evening. One is the ongoing confirmation process for Judge Sonia Sotomayor, as well as touch on some of the national sort of media carnival atmosphere around the recent confrontation between Harvard scholar Henry Louis Gates and a Cambridge police officer. But I wanted to go to the situation in the U.S. Senate with Judge Sonia Sotomayor. From all accounts, it's fairly assured that she will be confirmed by the U.S. Senate and take her place as the first Latino justice and the third female justice on the U.S. Supreme Court, replacing retiring Justice David Souter. And I wonder, as you kind of look at how this all played out, if you would assess, number one, Judge Sotomayor's judicial record and the questioning that she received in front of the Judiciary Committee in the U.S. Senate.
Well, her record is really quite impressive. She's had more previous judicial experience than really anybody who's come up for a nomination. And by all lights, she's been fairly moderate, I'd say, moderate liberal, something like that, in her decisions. Very scholarly, takes all sides very seriously, her opinions. When she does rule against someone, she never fails to explain their side as positively as possible. So it really seems like an obvious one to confirm, which it's turned out to be.
How do you analyze the Republican Party strategy here? There's a lot of sort of competing interests. Politically speaking, there was a great deal of concern, I'm sure, among Republican strategists. They didn't want to offend the growing numbers of Latino voters out there, which can spell the difference between victory and defeat, you know, in critical elections in the future. But at the same time, they were seeming to make a lot of Sotomayor's record on racial issues and stoking kind of like what's, you know, commonly referred to as the Southern strategy of polarization along racial lines that Richard Nixon was one of the founders of back in the day. But how do you think?
Well, I think they were pretty effective from their standpoint. They centered the debate around conservative ideas and on race and the predominant idea, really, which it fits the conservative court these days, is that discrimination is something that happens to white people in the form of reverse discrimination. And they were really quite effective. The other side to me was really quite disappointing. Of course we wanted to see her, and I supported her confirmation, but it certainly was an occasion for a debate about how judicial discretion is used, rather than this narrow view that the Democrats seem to put forward, and Judge Sotomayor did too. Almost this passive view of really an extreme passive view of judging, as if there's really no judgment at all. And of course, if you believe that, we shouldn't care who's on the Supreme Court. It's as if all results are predetermined and required, and the judge just writes them down. So I think we missed that moment. The same thing happened, by the way, during the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton's administration. So we lost an opportunity, I think, to move things ahead, for instance, to criticize the way the conservative court has been going for the last three decades.
in particular, what would you have liked to seen to have seen those who were supporting Judge Sotomayor? What would you like to have seen them stake claim to in these hearings, vis-a-vis affirmative action or any of the other, these other hot button cultural issues that the Republicans latch onto?
Well, I'd like to see a response to those, but also issues that that the Republicans tend to ignore. I mean, if you look at the record of the Supreme Court in this conservative period that started somewhere in the mid-70s, almost all of the winning plaintiffs in constitutional equality cases since about the mid-70s have been white men. And what's really happened, I think, I mean, we don't have time to do this in detail, but basically the court starting in 1954 with Brown v. Board of Education outlawed explicit discrimination, and of course the result was monumental, and the effects on society, I think, have been monumental. But that's about as far as the court went. It banned explicit, purposeful discrimination. It never got to, because it turned more conservative really pretty quickly in the mid-70s, it never got to the more subtle kinds of discrimination that, of course, are still with us. And the court acts as if those don't matter and aren't of any particular significance, or sometimes they seem to say that they're not real, they're not actually, it's not actually happening. They left all that just sitting there without challenging it. For instance, in the firefighter case that's made so much of, I think what's lost sight of is the Supreme Court gave all the promotions to the white candidates with the easy kind of assumption that, yeah, this test must be fine. It just validates that the whites did better than the blacks. Well, you know, we know we've had enough experience since Brown v. Board of Education to know that a test that seems to say only white candidates are the best should be viewed as factually suspect.
Right, but wasn't part of the problem with the firefighters' case that this test was given and people studied for it in good faith, and then the results come back and it's kind of like bait and switch? You know, you kind of switch the rules in the middle of the process. So wasn't that part of the complexity of that case as well?
Well, but nobody like had a legal right, if you got a certain grade, to they could reevaluate. And even if you redid it, you know, almost all of those whites would get promotions, at least down the road within years. The blacks are way underrepresented in the upper ranks of that fire department. In 1972, Congress amended Title VII, the employment discrimination laws, to include municipal governments, because when they looked into it, they found the record of discrimination by municipal governments was worse than that by private companies. And New Haven had that history. We had it here in Philadelphia and also still have the same problem. The Supreme Court took this suit up at this very early stage. It wasn't clear who was going to get the appointments, really, at that point. The city was unsatisfied with the test because they thought the test failed under Title VII because it seemed to be discriminatory. The city and the fire department knew that, and this is not affirmative action in the sense of giving anybody a preference, that if you picked the best people who were most likely to be the best officers in the fire department, it wouldn't turn out to be all white.
A lot of it, I guess, had to do with how much weight they gave the written test versus the records of these individuals.
In stone. I mean, none of them are correct or incorrect, you know. And so the city had just realized that this test was questionable, that the weight given to it was way more than other departments give to tests that even have been proven over the years to be validated. And so they were reevaluating. The actual changes, you know, might have been one or two of the whites might not have gotten, or three, the exact numbers could vary, might not have gotten their promotions right then, and one or two or three blacks might have. Probably most of the people near the top of the test would have gotten their promotion soon.
David Carries is our guest, professor of constitutional law at Temple University Law School and author of the book Philadelphia Freedom, which we'll say a word about in a little while. But for Professor Carries, is there any silver lining in this particular case in New Haven and the scrutiny which this case received in the Sotomayor confirmation process?
Well, I mean, there were lots of contradictions pointed out, but the media was unaware of them. For instance, I found Senator Hatch, you know, who goes on and on about judicial restraint. Well, he wanted Judge Sotomayor, when she was ruled on the firefighter case, to go against the established rules in her circuit, to be activist, essentially. He was upset that she wasn't activist enough, and she didn't have enough empathy, to use the word of the day, for these white firefighters. So there were lots of demonstrations like that of how little of principle is going on here, and how much of politics and various ideologies are struggling. But as I said, I was disappointed because the media didn't pick that up, nor did the Democrats lead them to any of it.
Professor Carries, what are some of the other forms of more subtle racial discrimination that you would have liked to have seen more politicians and the media itself take a closer look at or take a stand on?
Well, we've had basically a big change, of course, happened in the 60s and 70s, and going back into the 50s. A black middle class has emerged. There's been a lot of positive changes. But if you look at it for the majority of African-American people in large cities particularly, not much has changed. And it's hard to say they've had an opportunity and in any sense haven't produced. The opportunity really has never crystallized. So things like construction jobs or firefighters or police officers usually were passed down in families, in neighborhoods, ethnic people of the same ethnicity would help each other out. Like in Philadelphia, the police department and fire department were first all German and then Irish and then Italian. And of course, we allowed different forms of ethnic affirmative action. We didn't have the term then. Until it became the turn of African Americans to be incorporated into the middle class more massively, as other groups had done, really through municipal employment was a major vehicle, not the only one. So we've not allowed or not made progress on those counts in construction jobs. It's been very hard industry from the beginning to integrate. It goes on. It has an old craft background and uses apprenticeships. And people don't. The problem isn't people like Ku Klux Klan members, you know, spouting racial hatred. It's more people thinking, oh, you know, he might be a good carpenter. He's a lot like me. He shows a lot of the same signs and is very familiar. I'd like to work with him. There's no risk. He doesn't seem dangerous. That's sufficient just to keep on preferences for various groups that result in discrimination against other groups.
David Carries, what kind of, assuming for the moment that Judge Sotomayor will be confirmed and take her seat on the U.S. Supreme Court, how much influence do you think she'll have on this Supreme Court, which is decidedly conservative on many issues in recent years, especially with the addition of Chief Justice Roberts?
Yeah. It's very hard to say, and it requires some speculation. She will, like any justice, of course, realize that once she's on the Supreme Court, she's on the body that she always looked to for guidance, right? She was always trying to predict where they might go. And now, of course, she's one of them and has more discretion. She really did follow the precedent as best she could. And now, of course, she's making precedent. So I wouldn't be surprised, you know, that way that she was talked about almost as if she was hard to get along with and too pushy in a kind of condescending way by a lot of the Republicans. These are people who love Justice Scalia, for instance, who's about as pushy as they come. But I think she is a very active questioner, and judges vary on that. And so if she hits her stride on the Supreme Court, I think she will bring perspectives that are missing there out and could do it in a quite significant way. But that really is guessing. I think she'll at least be a kind of center-liberal, fairly reliable vote, kind of like Justice Souter was when he left.
There have been some progressive commentators that were critical of President Obama's choice of Sotomayor for this open seat, given that the Democrats have a unique opportunity with their 60-seat majority in the Senate, a filibuster-proof majority, where Obama could have certainly maybe picked somebody who was more of a progressive firebrand to counter the likes of Justices Roberts, Alito, and Thomas, to have some more balance there with an aggressive, progressive presence on the court. What do you think of that?
Well, I would I'm sure applaud that. It might have been very strategic to pick her in this sense that it's his first choice. And she's hard for the Republicans to vote against, or as hard as anyone you can think of, really, who he would want. I think whether that's what's going on and he's really just going to surrender this issue is yet to be revealed. And I hope the big revealing moment on this will come if and when he gets to replace one of the conservatives. Who's he going to replace them with? Maybe he'll have an opportunity like Bush did to do two justices at once, and that's often been an opportunity to move someone who might create more of a stir if up there alone. So I think it's a little too early to tell, and I think she's a reliable enough of a generally progressive or liberal vote that I certainly don't. I'm not ready to criticize in any serious way yet. I don't like the way they conducted the hearing. They could have been building consciousness, building understanding for these next nominations at this hearing.
Well, I wanted to turn our attention, before we say goodnight, Professor Carey's, to the issue which has been the subject of a media carnival, and that was the confrontation that occurred between Harvard scholar Henry Louis Gates and a Cambridge police officer up there in Massachusetts. What in your mind does this reveal? The confrontation itself, the news reports of it, and then President Obama's choice of words and the criticism that he received for talking about how stupid it was for the Cambridge Police Department to arrest this man in his own home.
Yes. Well, this is a good example where racism or something, you know, the word is so loaded these days, consideration of race where it shouldn't have much weight or any weight, maybe we put it that way. It wasn't that this officer is a Ku Klux Klan guy who uses the N-word or anything like that. I think it was a combination of big issues about the police that no one is quite talking about that really are independent of race. Whether or not they arrest him after they find out that he, in fact, it's his home and he's come home from this trip and he's upset, whether or not they arrest him seems to be, in that sense, the major issue. And there's been fighting actually about the scope of disorderly conduct and crimes like that, disturbing the peace. There are lots of Supreme Court cases on it that mostly say you can't, you know, just because a person is disrespectful or talks back or doesn't immediately do everything an officer wants, particularly in the person's own home, is not an allowable basis. Even if it does meet the statutory definition, it would violate his constitutional rights. And the police seem to be saying, we control the streets, we even control the houses to some extent, and if someone shows disrespect to us or doesn't do what we think they need to do when we think they need to do it, that makes it criminal. This is really a central issue all over the world about what we mean by freedom. It's interesting to me to see the conservative side that is talking about freedom all the time, but don't seem to be much concerned about Professor Gates's freedom. Again, that would be independent of race. But then, of course, the way all of us perceive the issue, including Professor Gates and the officer, Crowley, can't be independent of race. And in my book, I talked about, in the Philadelphia Freedom book, talked about when I first started practicing, and a judge gave two people very different bails. This was right in the early bail setting stage. They were both charged with drunk driving. They both had a prior incident. One was black and one was white. They both came from fairly middle class backgrounds, and the black got a very high bail and the white didn't. And you know, I was thinking, well, you know, it would hurt just as much if you got run over by a white guy as a black guy. They're just as dangerous. But there was a whole way in which the judge, I don't think consciously, perceived this man. He thought there was a risk. He thought he was dangerous, whereas the white man he just described as, well, you know, he had a few too many and probably should have asked someone else to drive him home. Those gradations and those kind of perceptions have a lot to do with race. And so now we're in this big denial, and to me, what Obama said first is pretty accurate. It not only was stupid, I think it just wasn't right to arrest the man for being disrespectful, essentially, even if you believe the police.
And I think that's probably addressed in the fact that the Cambridge Police Department decided to withdraw the charges. So if it was so smart as opposed to so stupid, they would have made the charges stick.
That's right. They knew if there was a trial, it would be hard to make out a case that Gates had done anything criminal.
What is it about the police department's relationship with African Americans, minorities in general, that a lot of these white legislators, as well as commentators on the radio and these right-wing talk shows, don't get? Because they seem to think there's some kind of level playing field out there in terms of the police treatment of whites and minorities are identical in sort of a...
I think one of the things that this conservative dominance, particularly about law and legal ideas in the last three decades, has done is to basically define racism as what I've been calling the Ku Klux Klan use of the N-word, and anything short of that is not racism. And simultaneously, they've latched on to something good that's happened. I mean, somewhere around World War II or thereafter, racism became wrong. Before that, you know, the daily conversation of regular, well-educated people was full of racial epithets, racist things that we would call blatantly racist stereotypes now. And there was this monumental change, of course, Brown v. Board is part of that, lots of other things are. Racism has become so wrong that the David Duke branch of the Klan now says they're not racist, they just happen to like to hang around white people. But they're not racist. So So we've had this, to me it's a very cultural as well as political, we've had this limited definition of what's a legitimate subject of racial discrimination. That seems to be explicit racist Klan-type activity. That's definitely wrong. It's good that that became wrong. But everything else, then, is okay. And the worst thing you can do is call someone a racist, because racism is so bad. So there's just so much contortion and denial in these things that I think are just deeply embedded in the culture. And so to me, the nomination process, since all this race stuff came up around Sotomayor, the Gates thing, both were just great moments for somebody like Obama, who's so good at this, to talk about it like he did in that Philadelphia speech during the campaign. But perhaps they've got their hands too full. Perhaps they can't step back and think that way yet. I'm still hopeful for him, but those were two of the times where we could have tried to get at some of this and say, well, maybe just ending discrimination, you know, wasn't enough, the worst kinds of discrimination, and removing it from the law, the explicit forms of discrimination wasn't enough. And, you know, we could have had a good discussion.
Professor Carey's beyond the issues of race, in this case involving Professor Henry Louis Gates, what about the issues of class? Here you have an elite Harvard professor versus a blue-collar cop on the beat in Cambridge. How much do you think class entered the picture here in this confrontation?
Oh, I think, again, it's like race. It couldn't help but enter, you know, and be combined, you know, class and race. Who is this, you know, intellectual who gets paid to do, you know, very little by the policeman's standard, and doesn't work as hard and doesn't take as much risks and has had advantages or is presumed to have had advantages? And then if you throw in, and this black intellectual, how dare he yell at me? You know, whereas, again, it's layers of empathy and of understanding, whereas once he found out this is the way race could subtly, I don't know that this happened, but it's possible, once he found out that Gates lives there, he's an elderly man, he walks with a cane, he came home from a long trip, he could have wound up in his mind thinking, perhaps, and more likely if it were a white professor, thinking, well, you know, this guy's letting off steam. He just had this trip. It is his house, and I'm invading his house. And really, there's no problem here. I'll walk away.
But he chose to do the other thing.
And I think you're right. Class played a role, as well as race.
Well, David Karras, I also wanted to ask you about some of the bizarre assumptions made by a lot of white commentators on this and related issues, and that is I hear a lot of people on TV and you read about it in the newspapers declaring that because we now have an African-American president in the White House that somehow all these racial issues have disappeared or should disappear because, you know, the problems of the past have now vanished. And, you know, you hear that subtly and you hear it overtly. How do you respond to that? Those kinds of assertions?
It's just pretty amazing. I mean, the first thing, of course, which makes it complicated is that it is, to me, downright amazing that we have a black president now. I certainly wouldn't. I've worked on race issues my whole adult life, and I wouldn't have predicted there could be any candidate, you know, I wouldn't have known of a Barack Obama who could get elected now in the United States of America. There were some unusual circumstances, the Republicans were repudiated, et cetera, and he was a brilliant politician, but it is rather amazing, and so that is a starting point. But, of course, there's always been, or always, there we take that same 30 years, going back 40 or 50 years, there's been standout exceptions where, you know, though there's huge unemployment in black communities, you know, there are some who rise up and do extremely well in the corporate world, at Harvard, at other places, and you know, he's just perhaps a more significant, of course, but a similar example. Most African Americans in urban areas still live in abject poverty, where they have terrible schools and terrible housing, no access to health care, inadequate nutrition, and nothing like equality of opportunity. Some will rise up, but the others are still there, and we will, of course, come back to this and maybe have to deal with the people who are saying it's over. For me, living in Philadelphia, when I go to my university, which is in North Philadelphia, one of the poorest areas of the city, it would be ridiculous to, on my drive to work, I'd like one of these people to maybe sit in the car with me and ride through these areas and tell me that racism or the effects of slavery, segregation, and race are over.
And certainly that's true in any American city all across this country.
Yes.
Professor Carey, just in closing here, please tell our listeners a bit about this brand new book that you've just published titled Philadelphia Freedom, Memoir of a Civil Rights Lawyer.
Well, it's something I thought of for some time and got the opportunity to write over several years. I couldn't do it all at once, but I was able to go back. I'm a bit of a pack rat, and I saved all my files. And it is some of the leading civil rights cases of the day, going back into the 60s and 70s. And I got to write it in a very non-legalistic style. It almost reads like a novel, as a story of basically a young white guy from Baltimore, me, who starts in college in engineering because he's told that he doesn't have to take any more languages. Later, of course, regretted that I didn't learn languages at a young enough age. But I went to college in the 60s. I was at the March on Washington in 63 at Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And what started as kind of a sidelight in a life devoted to engineering and business and making a lot of money became the focus of my life, civil rights, litigation, and political activism. So it's a story of how that happened in a very personal way, and fortunately the early reviews and comments have been really quite encouraging.
Unfortunately, I didn't get a copy in advance of our interview tonight, but we could certainly have you back to talk more about the book and related issues.
Well, publisher send one to you, Scott.
Please do that, and I appreciate you making time for us tonight and to delve into this very important discussion of race, which, again, it just seems to me, over the course of especially this Henry Louis Gates incident, just seems to be kind of an irresponsible a carnival in the media about it without scratching too deeply beyond the surface of these issues. So I'm happy for what you shared with us tonight about this topic. Thanks so much.
Well, thanks for inviting me on.
Take care. Good night.
So long.
That was Professor David Carey's Professor of Constitutional Law, Temple University Law School, and author of the brand-new book titled Philadelphia Freedom, Memoir of a Civil Rights Lawyer. We're going to take a quick break here with some music by Bob Marley and be back in just a moment to discuss the future of a new universal health care bill that just passed the House and Senate here in the state of Connecticut, overriding a veto of Republican Governor Jody Rell. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. is WPKN Radio in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. Right now, I'd like to welcome to the program Bob Slate. He's a spokesperson with the Universal Healthcare Foundation of Connecticut, one of the groups primarily responsible for the passage of an historic universal health care bill called Sustinet that we've talked about on this program previously. And last Monday, July 20th, the Connecticut House and Senate overrode a veto of Republican Governor Jody Rell to pass the Sustinet bill, which is a blueprint for bringing health care to every citizen or nearly every citizen of the state of Connecticut. And Bob Slate, thank you so much for being here with us tonight to talk about Sustinet. And I, first of all, want to congratulate you on a multi-year effort here that's paid off. And I'm not sure if you expected a victory this year, but I know with all the hard work your group has done, you richly deserve it. But what was your reaction to the override of the veto on Monday?
I have to say my first reaction was shock, as in, did it really happen? Did we really do it? When I saw the Senate vote to override 2412, because we needed 24 senators, and we got 24 senators, so the first reaction was shock. Then kind of a wow, we did it, and people who were watching online or on TV in our office kind of hugged each other, and I then stepped back and said again, wow, we really did it. So I should say there throughout this campaign there's been a lot of energy and excitement, and definitely a sense that, as our President Juan Figueroa says, si se puede, yes, we can. But on the other hand, many of us, myself included, have been involved with many different progressive campaigns for social change that came up short or settled for an increment or two. So for me personally, and I know for some others with the foundation and with our Healthcare for Everyone campaign, this was a real wow moment. We did it. We overcame some incredible odds. I mean, when you're working against a very popular governor, when you're working against a very powerful insurance industry, when you're working against, you know, a lot of people that have major financial incentives to maintain the healthcare status quo, you know, you're inevitably the underdog. So wow.
Well, you know, as you say, the symbolism of this victory is quite important, given that Connecticut and Hartford in particular is the insurance capital of the country for many, many decades. So this is, it certainly signifies a lot more than just a battle here in Connecticut. This was significant nationwide, to be sure. Bob, tell our listeners about what Sustinet is. I think, you know, people are, now that it's passed and it's going to become law or is law, people want to know more about it, what exactly it means for themselves and their family when it comes to health care in the next couple of years.
Sure. Sustinet is law as of July 1st. So it's not the bill anymore, the plan, it's the law. Just one thing I should make clear to people, in order to pass Sustinet this year, given the economic crisis in Connecticut and throughout the U.S., one thing we did strategically was to pass the plan without passing the full funding for the plan yet. So we've got an 18-month window in which from now until January 2011, we will develop the implementation mechanisms and the funding mechanisms for the plan, so that it's ready to go to the legislature in 2011 for a final vote of approval with funding. So people should know that there'll be some time, and as we believe is appropriate, because this is a total transformation of our healthcare system in Connecticut, such that hasn't happened in any state in the country, and certainly not nationally. So that it's good that we're taking time, and I think, and the first steps will be actually by Friday of this week, a nine-member board, the Sustinet board, will be appointed. The co-chairs are already set in stone, and that will be the state comptroller and the state healthcare advocate. Seven more people will join them, and they will, working with some task force and committees that they set up, develop the fine details of the Sustinet plan and the funding. But the outline is clearly set, and what we're talking about with Sustinate is the creation of a public plan. I'd like to say that we like to say that it kind of it dwarfs what's being talked about at the national level in the sense that our public plan is really open and inviting to people, everyone who needs it. We didn't spend a long time haggling about how to keep people out and how to limit people. Our goal was to create a public plan that was large enough to meet the needs of the uninsured and underinsured, and large enough to get us economies of scale, so there'd be huge savings in terms of negotiating prices for drugs and medications, just in terms of negotiating any kinds of costs. So large enough so that we could have a cost savings to provide affordable care through the Sustinate plan. In its first stages, Sustinate will take the state employee plan and allow all municipalities and nonprofits, small businesses, people who are uninsured, that's 325,000 state residents and 40,000 children, and I believe 16,000 uninsured in Bridgeport alone, allow them to join, as well as rolling in Husky A and Husky B members, Medicaid members, SAGA members, and people who have group insurance to their employer, but the insurance is either so expensive or so inadequate that it doesn't meet their needs. So we're pulling those people together into a pool where they would have a health care plan of high quality in terms of benefits and sliding scale so that everybody can afford the plan and have quality, affordable health care. And once Sustinate is fully in place, either through their employer who's offering a great plan or through Sustinate, everybody or virtually everybody, because, you know, there may be some people that want to join, everybody in Connecticut will be certain and secure in knowing that they will always have quality, affordable health care. We talk about financial security. This is healthcare security, and that's what Sustinate's about.
Who right now operates the state of Connecticut's employees' health insurance plan? And that is the plan that you're talking about will be expanded by quite a bit in terms of municipal employees, nonprofit employees, and people currently without insurance. In other words, that particular, I believe it's a plan run by a private insurance company, that's going to be opened up to these other groups of people. And maybe you could talk about, well, who runs that plan and the numbers in terms of potentially how many people can join this plan as opposed to how many are members right now?
Well, the first thing you should know is that with Sustinate, that plan will become self-insured, as like many large corporations are. They provide insurance to their employees and contract the administration out to an insurance company. So the state employee plan would become self-insured. And then in terms of numbers, I don't have an exact count on the number of state employees in the plan now, but it would grow significantly depending on how many municipalities and nonprofits decided to join, and our goal would be to get it to grow as large as possible. And within that plan, there would be cost control. So, I mean, we've heard fears that everybody's going to have state employee health care. Well, first of all, a belief at the foundation is that we shouldn't lower the health care coverage of people who might have decent care in order to level the playing field. We should set as a high standard for health insurance. We're not running away from what's been unfairly tainted as gold-plated insurance, when if you look at it, what it really is health care that you can count on. And that's what we're doing. So we would open up that pool, and that the cost savings will be really significant once the pool gets large enough that it can negotiate with large numbers. So we're hoping that pool gets as large as possible. On the other hand, if private employers, see the Sustinate pool growing and decide they want to compete and have more members, then it's certainly up to them to be able to provide health insurance products that are as comprehensive and as affordable as the Sustinate plan is. I mean, nobody's being forced to buy the Sustinate plan. they can always get private insurance, and the challenge would be to the private insurers to be able to meet the needs in a way that many people feel the private insurance companies and the free market is not doing right now.
So, Bob Slate, this really will, it's a privately run insurance program right now for state employees, but this will morph into a publicly run plan. As you said, the management may be farmed out to a private company, but basically it will be a state of Connecticut public health care plan that will be competing with private insurance in the marketplace with all these various groups of people having to make decisions of, well, do I want to go with the Connecticut plan, the state of Connecticut plan, or do I want to stick with what I got or shop around?
Right. Yeah. I mean, some cases it will be employers in a second phase of the plan. Employers will be able to have their entire company or business join the plan and offer sustenance, you know, offer sustenance to everybody. But that's kind of a phase two. But in that phase one, yeah, we'll be offering a plan that that we think will be attractive to particularly to the people now who are certainly the people who are uninsured. A huge group of people that are really supportive of Sustinet are private contractors, consultants, and so on. One of our biggest supporters and advocates has been the Connecticut Association of Realtors, and they've got, you know, 15,000-plus members. And I didn't realize this until we started working with them, but, you know, the people who work for Century 21 or what have you, they aren't paid by Century 21. They're as employees, they're consultants, and they get no health insurance. So there's thousands of people out there, you know, selling and buying homes that all have to go into the individual market, which can be ridiculously, prohibitively expensive.
Well, especially these days when real estate is at such rock bottom. So yeah.
And also, I mean, one thing we learned from the realtors is that, I mean, they see people who are having to sell homes under dire circumstances, and they see that, you know, in at least 50% of the cases, medical debt is a major factor contributing to the need to sell the home or the home foreclosure. So they experience their personal health care crisis, health coverage crisis, as they try to get their own coverage. But they also see people even worse shape, and they know that people aren't going to be buying houses if they can't afford health care.
Bob Slate, I know one of the reasons that Republican Governor Jody Rell stated that she vetoed the Sustinet bill was that she said, you know, at a time of financial crisis for the state of Connecticut, it was irresponsible to even, you know, kick the can down the road in terms of the enormous amount of dollars that will be needed to finance Sustinet. As you said, in 2011, you're going to have to allocate the money to get this program off and running.
Yeah, she's right about the irresponsibility, but the irresponsibility would be to not address the problem now, because it's not going to go away. The longer we wait, the more money will have been wasted, and the greater debt the state will go into. Simply because, I mean, healthcare takes up a huge, I believe it's about a third of state spending is on Medicaid and other state programs. Those costs are only going to skyrocket. So the longer we delay, the more it will cost the state to dig out of this health care mess, which eventually they'll have to do. If we don't solve this crisis, then employers won't be able to offer any kind of insurance to their employees, so businesses won't grow. Families will increasingly go bankrupt if they can't meet their out-of-pocket costs. So the responsible thing to do would be to punt completely or to stick with the governor's Charter Oak program, which I believe it now insures 8,000 out of the 325,000 uninsured people in the state. So what we did, what we thought was responsible, which was, okay, we're not spending any money now, because right now is a particularly awful time. Most economists believe the economy will turn around at least within 2 years. And so we did the responsible thing, which is committing the state to no dollars now. And, once we're ready to go ahead with Sustinet, we would have developed funding mechanisms, which will include contributions from the consumer, contributions from employers, federal dollars, and we'll be action ready, as we say, for any money that comes down through federal health care reform and some contributions by the state. The legislature will have to sign off on that. So if it's clearly unaffordable, then, and we don't believe it will, we wouldn't, the assessment board wouldn't present an unaffordable plan, then the state can still still conceivably say, wait, we can't afford it. But again, the cost of doing nothing is two or three times the cost of doing something. We're paying it all now with the uninsured using emergency rooms at great expense to hospitals. Hospitals get reimbursed from the state. Insurance companies shift the costs of that care to us, to our premiums. That's just one of the ways that we're paying already now. I mean, in the entire United States, I mean, you probably know we've got the most expensive per-person healthcare system in the world, and yet our outcomes are slipping rapidly, so that the average lifespan in the U.S. is, it's way behind a number of third world countries. Mm-hmm. So we're spending huge amounts in Connecticut and in the nation. We're not getting good results. We've got 50 million uninsured in the U.S. and at least 325,000, probably more, in Connecticut. And as I mentioned, enough children uninsured that you could fill up 1,000 of those bright yellow school buses, and still not contain all of the kids who can't, see a dentist or can't get a checkup. So we don't feel that it's responsible to delay this solution to the healthcare crisis, which has been the pattern for this governor in the past.
Well, Bob, we're running out of time very quickly, and I just had two very quick questions for you. Number one, we have our neighbor to the north, Massachusetts, which has implemented a plan which has gotten a lot of mixed reviews. One of the elements of their plan was that they require people to buy insurance, with available subsidies or not. But if they don't choose to buy insurance, then they will be fined substantially. That's not part of this plan here in Connecticut, is it?
No. What we have is we have many ways in which people would be automatically enrolled if they go to enroll in a school or a new job or such, but they can always opt out of the plan. So we decided not to go with a mandate. And what we believe is that if you offer a plan, that is affordable, that people will sign up. I mean, there are very few people who reach applicable age and don't get Medicare. I mean, there are very few people who reach school age and don't go to school, at least a public school, because those are services that we all understand are necessary and they're all affordable. And a mandate may be necessary if people really believe they can't afford, health care. But we believe that if you've got a plan out there that really provides good coverage that is affordable, and realistically looking at people's expenses, not based on some arcane system of what's affordable or not, then people will join, and we won't need that kind of a mandate, and we won't need those penalties, which can be pretty onerous.
And Bob, just one, and we only got like about 30 seconds here, but I wanted to ask you this. How will this system here in Connecticut, the SustaNet system, interact, and I guess it's hard to answer this, with a future national health care plan that may be passed by Congress and signed into law by Barack Obama? That's almost an impossible question to answer, I guess, given that we don't know it.
I'm just kidding.
Well, I'm just thinking there may very well be something. We don't know the details of it. But is this plan designed to interact with that?
Yeah, there's a requirement within our plan that within 60 days of the passage of a federal reform plan, whether it involves a public plan or not, the SustaNet Board has to submit recommendations to the legislature as to how our plan would work with the federal plan and how we would make sure it worked and how we would maximize any federal dollars and be action ready and first in line for federal dollars. If the federal government, it's not looking that way now, but if they were able to pass a wonderful program that covered the uninsured, then we wouldn't need SustaNet. Then within 60 days of that happening, the board would meet with the legislature and say, look, they've done it nationally. SustaNet, our goal as a foundation is to get everyone coverage, whether it's federal, state, But we don't want to wait any longer. I mean, I think it was Teddy Roosevelt was the first president to bring up universal health care as part of his platform, and then Nixon had ideas, and of course we know Bill Clinton had ideas, and it's been, nationally, the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industries have a lot of clout, and they're flexing all those muscles every day now with this House and especially the Senate. So we don't know what's going to happen there. We're not going to wait for a solution, but if something comes down the pike, good, strong or weak, we'll be ready to react, instantaneously.
All right. Well, I'm sorry we're out of time, but Bob, tell our listeners how they get more information about Sustin on your website.
Sure.
And we'll certainly have you and others from the foundation back again to talk more about this stuff. But what's the website?
Sure. The website is healthcare4everyone.org. Healthcare4everyone.org. And they can also call 203-639-0550. 203-639-0550. And they can get as much information as they want or need, either online or in talking to our staff members about what Sustin is and what it will mean to them.
All right. Well, thanks again, Bob. I appreciate you being here. And again, congratulations on the victory with Sustin.
Thanks, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to your audience.
We'll be doing more on this later. Thanks, Bob. Bye-bye. Bob Slate, spokesperson with the Universal Healthcare Foundation of Connecticut, primary backers of the Sustinet bill, just passed House and Senate here in the state of Connecticut, overriding Governor Rell's veto last Monday. That's it for our program. Go online to find out more about this station, how to volunteer, how to contribute at WPKN.org. This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk, New York at 88.7 FM. Chris Ferriero is up next, so stick with him. He'll be here till at least midnight, maybe beyond. I don't know the schedule. It's a little bit in flux. But thank you all for listening. We'll be back with another program, Counterpoint, next Monday at 8 p.m. Always like to hear your feedback, criticisms, praise, suggestions for topics and guests. Call us at 203-331-9756 or write to this station at WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also email me, Scott Harris, at betweenthelines@snet.net. Betweenthelines@snet.net. And Between the Lines, actually, the program we aired a little bit earlier tonight, you go to our website, btlonline.org, and you can get the complete current and past archived programs. That's btlonline.org. And Counterpoint is archived at the website whiterosesociety.org. Thanks for listening. Again, Chris Ferriero is next. Stay tuned.
Loved one.